And she said, "Are you as crazy as he is?" The children even had problems in school, continued Popeye, because the parents of the other children did not believe in all this. Atlantis went to kindergarten and the children always made fun of him. They called him UFO Mia. He came home crying so many times. I told him to go to the teacher, but the teacher didn't believe in all this either. He told me that my husband and I were doing weird things with UFOs and that this wouldn't be the best influence for the kids. I told Billy it would have been better if none of this had happened. See, that summer, 1976, just before all of the publicity on Mia's alleged contacts with the Pleiadians, Hans Schutzbach had accompanied Mia one afternoon to a secluded meadow not far from Hinwil. There, in the presence of Schutzbach, Mia held out a tape recorder and captured the sounds made by one of the beam ships. The sound, an eerie and grating noise, like a high-pitched cross between a jet engine and a chainsaw, thought Schutzbach, seemed to emanate from a point in open air about 30 feet above Mia. When Mia raised his hand and circled it, the sound increased. When he lowered his hand, the sound softened. Then the two, loud and soft, interlaced in an ethereal resonance. Suddenly Mia made an angry gesture and the sounds stopped altogether. Schutzbach turned and saw a game warden and a policeman, one with binoculars, plus another policeman with a dog and two men on motorcycles. Before Schutzbach left the scene, he had a real good look around, combing the nearby landscape, walking to the few trees dotting the meadow and examining their branches. He saw no speakers, cables, or balloons, nothing. 2 days later Schutzbach secretly returned to the same meadow with two friends, and the three of them tried to recreate the sounds using the tape he had made with Mia. They hung speakers high in the trees and used amplifiers, but the apparatus was obvious and the sound weak and distant. Hans Schutzbach drove Mia to perhaps 20 of his contacts in the forests outside Hinwil, many of them on cold, damp nights. A self-proclaimed nosy person, he watched Mia closely, but never saw him make anything or handle any materials that could have been used to fabricate the sounds or the photographs. Schutzbach's biggest problem, though, was the strange landing tracks. Whenever the beam ships left them in the tall grass, he would help Mia measure and photograph them. Schutzbach thought about them often. He saw many people try to prove Mia a fraud by duplicating the tracks, but they always looked much different. The tracks made by Billy were perfect, Schutzbach said, the ones by other people were a bad copy. On the night of June 13, 1976, several people accompanied Mia to a clearing in the forest where he was to have a contact with the Pleiadians. It was 2 a.m. when they arrived. Mia told them that to demonstrate the Pleiadians' existence, Semjays had consented to a light display where the ships would take on color and fly in erratic patterns. Among those who waited was Guido Moosbrugger, the principal of a small school in Austria. Moosbrugger had first come in contact with Mia a few months earlier when he traveled to Munich to attend a series of monthly lectures on UFOs. At one of the lectures, Mia had been invited to speak and to show some of his photographs. "I was so fascinated by those pictures," recalled Moosbrugger, "I sent a letter immediately to him in Hinwil and asked him whether I might visit him." Mia had consented and Moosbrugger visited Hinwil in mid-May 1976. During his stay, Moosbrugger had followed Mia to a contact, Mia on his moped, Moosbrugger and Schutzbach in a car. The three men had driven along a dirt path through a field until Mia signaled for them to stop. Then, he had told Schutzbach and Moosbrugger to wait there. He took off on his motorbike to where the contact would take place, remembered Moosbrugger. "After he left, I thought to myself, I wonder what would happen if I would follow him to see where he went." When he came back from the contact, he said that Semjays had welcomed him with the words, "You brought two men with you." Mr. Moosbrugger had a thought for a short moment, what would happen if he would follow you. "It didn't concern me though, that was just his honest interest." The two men had sat in the car waiting for Mia to return when high above the tree line 2 miles away they saw a fire red disc as big as the headlights from a distance of 100 meters. The red disc moved back and forth, then suddenly disappeared. After a few seconds, a rotating silver ball spun into view, then two smaller silver spheres appeared beneath the first, also spinning. At the base of the central and largest of the spinning spheres, a large drop formed and hung lower and lower until it broke free and plummeted, disappearing in 2 or 3 seconds. Suddenly all of the lights had disappeared. After another pause, Moosbrugger explained later, the very same disc appeared again, became bigger and bigger, and we thought it flew toward us. Then it shrank and disappeared. Moosbrugger had seen exotic fireworks displays before, but what he saw that night seemed more solid and vivid, like a color cartoon taking place in the blackened Swiss sky, not little explosions of gunpowder, but more the brilliant illumination of strangely behaving physical objects. Later he wrote, "Of course, I cannot be angry if somebody does not believe this story, if they cannot or do not want to accept it as reality. I don't mind if people call me crazy or say I have lots of imagination, but I do not want to be called a liar." Moosbrugger knew nothing about using a 35mm single-lens reflex camera, but he would not return to Hinn without one. From a friend he borrowed a Pentax, a tripod, and a telephoto lens and had his friend load film into the camera for him, and set the adjustments for nighttime exposures. 3 weeks later, Moosbrugger had returned to Hinn, and he now stood in the dark beneath tall pines at the edge of the clearing, his Pentax and his telephoto lens mounted on the tripod. Out of his sight, Hans Schutzbach and his brother, Comrade, also had positioned themselves in the woods, each with a camera. Nearby, the rest of the group ate cake, sipped hot coffee, and watched the dark sky from a knoll. Suddenly, over the forest, they saw first a red disc, then a silver disc. The lights hovered, then grew, then just as suddenly disappeared. Moosbrugger got the red disc on film. He then bent over his tripod to adjust the angle of his camera when a third disc-shaped object appeared, this one alternating brilliant colors. When Moosbrugger looked up again, this disc had gone, but immediately, very high in the sky, he saw another silver disc edge on, a bar of intense light, with a glittering rain of fire falling straight down. Moosbrugger captured this last disc on film, an image that looked like a huge brilliant jellyfish with tentacles drifting across the sky. Before and after Moosbrugger photographed the disc, the intense yellow-white bar changed its form several times, then softened to a glow, and the observers on the ground saw the luminous ball fly slowly away until it was only a bright red speck in the distance. Then, it ascended rapidly and disappeared. Mir had had his 55th contact. The articles released in the summer and fall of 1976 persuaded more and more people to travel to Hinn to see Mir. Every weekend, visitors came to the house, sometimes as many as 20, some of them familiar, some of them new. All of them wanted to see Mir's photographs of the beamships and to hear about life elsewhere in the universe. What is the Pleiadian culture like? Their government? Their society? How advanced is their technology? How do they communicate with Mir? What do they look like? Are their intentions peaceful? According to Mir, the Pleiadians lived to be 1,000 years old. Samjays herself was comparatively young, 330. Her home planet, Era, was only slightly smaller than Earth, yet was populated by far fewer people, less than 500 million. Upon discovering Era's hospitable but young environment, the Pleiadians themselves had engineered the planet to support life, and today its landscape looked much like the countryside found on Earth, with hills, grass, trees, and running water. They located production and processing facilities in remote regions, away from the population, and utilized nearby uninhabited planets for mining. The Pleiadians told Mir that were he to travel to Era, he would find species similar to the horse, cow, rabbit, and fish. Robots and androids performed most physical labor on Era. The androids looked and acted so human that the only way to distinguish them from humans was by their dress. Each wore a uniform, the color indicating the job the android was assigned to perform. They appeared unusually lifelike because their skin was made of living protoplasm, and their brain, too, was an organism capable of natural responses and conversation. Families not only existed on Era, but they were purportedly tight and caring. Though sexually mature in their early teens, Palladians did not marry until after they had completed their education, a process that began when they were 4 years old and lasted until they reached 70. By that time they would have acquired specific skills in 15 or 16 disciplines, or, in the case of some Jays, as many as 30. There was no government. They have, what you call here, spiritual leaders, Mia told those who came to see him. And the highest form that they have for their leadership they call Horaft. It's a form of life that's not hard face and body, and not a real spiritual form. It's a middling between both of them. If you put your hand into them, it will go through. The Horaft will not give out orders. They give out something else, what we call suggestions. And then, each one on the planet, by his own wisdom in evolution, tries to do his best out of this. With all of the people coming to her home, to see her husband, taking up his time, Bopai felt as alienated as she had when she first moved to Switzerland. When she was only 17, Popeye had met Mia on Christmas Day, 1965, in the city of Thessaloniki, Greece. Mia was then nearly 29. Only a few months earlier he had lost his left arm. A month after they met, Mia had asked Popeye to marry him, and when the girl's mother would not consent, the two of them fled to a small town where they were married on February 13, 1966. For 4 years afterward they had traveled from Switzerland to India and back again, working and living in Pakistan, on the Isle of Crete, in the mountains of the Middle East, and in India. When they returned to Switzerland, Popeye understood little of the Swiss German spoken in her husband's country. A few years later, when the contacts began, she communicated better in Swiss German, but she still knew so little High German that she found her husband's writings about the contacts difficult to read. "I tried to read them," she remembered, "but I just didn't understand anything. So I made myself a wrong picture of all this." "It got bad," she continued, "when all these people began coming to Hinal to see my husband. Most of them were women, and he used to take many of them to the contact sites. I was very jealous at that time. Not that I was thinking he would see another woman. It's just that nobody ever said they would watch my children so I could go with him. They just came to him and said, 'Let's go.' So I was very angry." One of those who now attended the meetings regularly was Bernadette Brand, a computer technician. In July 1976, she was riding the train home from work one evening, reading Quick magazine, when she saw the article on Mia. "I remember saying to my colleague," she later recalled, "another crazy who says he is having contact with extraterrestrials. He asked me whether I believe that baloney. I said, 'Of course extraterrestrials exist, but why would they come here? If they went anywhere it would be to a place where they could learn something, but not here.' I thought it was awful that somebody said he was having contact and fooling people. You should put them behind bars. All of them." Brand knew the Schutzbach brothers, Hans and Conrad. When they told her about an invalid they knew who claimed to have contact with beings from another star system, she failed to connect their story with the article she had seen in Quick. She said to them, "Another crazy around here." Conrad tried to tell Bernadette about Mia, but she would not listen. "Don't be so stupid," she said. "You don't understand," said Conrad, "you have no idea." And the two of them argued about Mia for the rest of the summer. One Saturday evening in the fall, Conrad brought his friend Jacob Spurchinger to Bernadette's apartment for dinner. The whole time, remembered Bernadette, they were talking about some woman, like, "Don't take her seriously. When she's jealous she makes everybody crazy." After dinner the three of them drove to Hinal to see a friend of Conrad's who lived in an old farmhouse in the middle of several apartment buildings. He did not tell her the friend was Eduard Mia, though as they turned off Weihaldenstrasse onto the long alleyway, Bernadette guessed who lived there. By now she was willing to meet the man. A woman met them at the front door and said, "Wait here. You can't come in yet." Then she whispered to Conrad. When they finally entered the house, Conrad told Bernadette, We can't go into the living room. There is a discussion going on in there. In the kitchen, Bernadette brewed coffee for the people in the living room, and while their coffee percolated, a woman ran though carrying a large container of water swirling with coal dust. Most households kept this especially fine grade of coal dust for emergencies, to induce vomiting in children. Bernadette wondered, has someone tried to commit suicide? Then, Mia himself walked into the kitchen and told Bernadette to come into the living room with the coffee. Immediately, she saw a woman with long dark hair slumped over in a chair, and another woman washing her arms and forehead with cold water and patting her on her cheeks to keep her awake. But the woman in the chair was white, like snow, her head drooping. Popeye had swallowed close to 50 sleeping pills. A second woman replaced the first, continuing to bathe her in cool water and pat her on the cheeks. Bernadette thought, if these people keep on doing it this way, this woman is going to die. When the second woman complained of being tired, Bernadette offered to take her place. She was not as gentle as the other two. She slapped the woman across the face as hard as she could. Then she slapped her again and again. The woman started to whimper and said to stop hitting her. Her teeth hurt so bad. If you keep your eyes open, said Bernadette, I won't hit you anymore. But the woman again nodded off, and Bernadette slapped her face hard. She wanted to make her angry. For 3 hours, Bernadette slapped the woman's face. Then suddenly, the woman leapt out of the chair, grabbed Bernadette, and knocked her to the floor. The woman, though slight, was unbelievably strong, and tossed the 160-pound Bernadette around the living room until Mia stepped in and helped Bernadette subdue her. Then, Mia wrestled his wife into a bed and told her if she fell asleep she would have to come back into the living room. But she closed her eyes again, and Bernadette slapped her across the face. The woman hit her back, screaming and cursing her husband. Using only one hand, Mia whipped off his belt, got it around her wrists, wrapped it quickly around the back of her knees, and fastened her to a chair. Popeye continued to curse him and the others, then closed her eyes and started to nod off again. Bernadette slapped her. Then again and again. Suddenly, Popeye strained against the leather belt and broke it. But just as suddenly, she seemed to calm down. It was almost 6 a.m. She had last vomited at midnight, and the toxicology center had told them to keep her awake for 6 hours after she had emptied her stomach of the remaining pills. Bernadette quit, and the other two women went back to washing the woman's face and limbs in cold water. One Saturday afternoon, a few weeks after Popeye's attempted suicide, Bernadette accompanied Conrad to a meeting at the Hill House with about 50 other people. Though she had expected to despise Mia, she found him gentle and honest, not the schwindler she had imagined him to be. And this caused confusion because what the man said of his contacts and his trips into outer space still sounded crazy to her. In a short while, she was coming often to the Hill House. And late one night, after she had been to see Mia, she was driving home from Hill alone. As I was driving, I got this feeling all of a sudden that I had to stop. I thought, you are crazy. All these ships and stuff make you crazy. So I drove on. But that feeling came again, a very strong feeling that I had to stop, so I stopped the car and stayed inside, locking all the doors. Then, I waited in the dark, curious what would happen. I was looking out the window from my side when I saw a light rise above the forest. It was snow white, about the width of my hand from where I sat. It stopped for a moment, then went back down, and when it sank back, it was fire red. I thought somebody was playing with fireworks, but this was so precise. Rockets don't do that. I waited a while and after 1 or 2 minutes, it rose again. Then, all of a sudden, it was gone. I thought, should I drive on? No, wait a little longer. And indeed a little farther away, it is hard to estimate, maybe 500 or 600 meters, an orange light rose, again from behind the forest. It rose very slowly, and it was very big. I would say it was a quarter the size of the moon. This orange light rose and then looked like it was going upstairs, zigzag, and then very quietly, it flew away. I could see it for about 20 minutes. From that area, you are able to see the Alps, and I saw it disappear in the Alps. It got smaller and smaller. 3 on a Friday night, in the early summer of 1976, Herbert Runkel and Harald Brock, men in their late 20s from Munich, were cruising the Autobahn to Augsburg in an older cream Mercedes. With the windows rolled up, they listened to The White Rose, a radio program from East Germany that aired every Friday at midnight. Each of them held a spicy German sausage in one hand and a liter of Coke in the other. Herbert, who was in charge of quality control at his father's insulation factory, smoked his Camels. Harald, a professional photographer with a neatly trimmed dark beard, cradled a pipe. They had been close friends now for 6 years. The Friday night drives on the Autobahn to Augsburg had become a ritual, a time to talk. As always, they talked of many things, but one thing that Harald specifically wanted to mention that night was an intriguing article he had recently seen in Quick magazine about a man living in Switzerland who claimed to have had contact with beings from another star system. And the contacts, said the man, still occurred regularly. The article even mentioned U.S. presidential candidate Jimmy Carter as one who had seen a UFO when he was governor of Georgia. Harald had had his own unexplained sighting when he was only 5 years old. He later told the story, that was on the island where I was born. We were at the beach one afternoon, and suddenly from the seaside, there came a flying saucer, two or three, I don't remember exactly. They stood still, a little bit in motion for about 1 minute, maybe 50 meters high. They were big, it's difficult to say how big. They were there for 1 or 2 minutes and like a shot, they were gone without acceleration. Gone. I never forgot that. I asked my mother. I asked other people, what is that? This is not an airplane, what is that? Nobody could tell me. Nobody could explain to me what they were, why they were here, what it meant. That was in the 50s, 1953, 1954. I was so fascinated. I will never forget that picture. On their Friday night journeys to Augsburg, Herbert and Harald often had philosophized about the universe, the existence of extraterrestrial societies, the possibilities of travel into space over cosmic distances. As many do, we were trying to find a truth, explained Harald, but without religion. Herbert, a compulsive reader, had read UFO stories before. One of these was about the most famous contactee ever, the American George Adamski. Adamski had lived on the southern slope of Mount Palomar. In November 1952, he claimed he had had a conversation with a man of slight stature and shoulder-length blonde hair who landed in the California desert in a scout ship from Venus. The alien had come to Earth because his people were concerned about radiations going out from Earth, caused by the exploding of atomic bombs. Adamski had traveled the world, famous as the first person to claim contact with extraterrestrial beings. He, of course, was a controversial figure, and his few murky photographs of the scout ship, Herbert had read, actually were superimposures using part of an icebox machine as a model. In the other cases, said Herbert, the people always talk about religion, how the space people are sent by God to help the people on Earth, and that's all crazy. For someone who thinks logically, it is nothing. No. He told Harald, I'm finished with UFOs. I read about Adamski, I believe there are extraterrestrial people. But all these stories in magazines are hoaxes. Before you say that, you should look at the pictures from Switzerland, said Harald. You have never seen pictures with quality like this. A photographer with many years' experience, Harald had been impressed with the pictures in the magazine, and he described each one in detail for Herbert. When they returned from their late night journey to Augsburg, it was early morning though still dark. A night person requiring little sleep, Herbert regularly went to bed at 3, 4, 5 o'clock in the morning, slept for a few hours, then was ready to start the day. That night, he was not interested in sleep, he went, instead, to Harold's apartment to see the article that had so impressed his friend. When Harald unfolded the magazine in front of him, Herbert saw immediately why the photographs had caught his eye. The two-page spread featured a black and white photograph of a large silvery ship hovering high above a valley near Hinwil. A series of three smaller pictures showed a similar ship in various positions around a tall pine. In another picture, in a field of grass, stood Mir himself, a handsome man with hair thinning in the front, and a well-developed right shoulder and forearm. The left sleeve of his white shirt drooped and rose, neatly pinned to his shoulder. When Herbert saw the layout, he grinned. This is a better hoax than the rest. In the past, nearly every report of unusual sightings of claims of contact that Herbert had read about had occurred in South America or the United States, nowhere he could conveniently investigate himself. But this time it was in Europe. Harold spread a map across his desk, and they found the village of Hinwil to be a little southeast of Zurich, no more than a 4 or 5 hour drive from Munich. The two of them decided they would drive to Hinwil the following weekend and try to find Mir and talk to him. It was just curiosity to see if it was true, Harold said later. On Saturday morning the following weekend, Herbert and Harold left Munich at daylight and headed south, crossing the Swiss border just after sunup. Driving to Winterthur, then down through the villages near the Pfeffiker See, they arrived in Hinwil at about 10 o'clock. Not knowing Mia's address, they drove to a kiosk in town where an old woman selling newspapers and candy told them that Mia lived in a large farmhouse at number 10 Wilhaldenstrasse. "Why do you want to see him?" she asked. "He's crazy." When Herbert and Harold arrived at the farmhouse, Mia was not at home and would not return for at least 2 hours. Popa invited them inside for coffee, but they declined. At 2 in the afternoon, with Mia still gone, Hans Schutzbach arrived. A few minutes later, Popeye came out to the car and told Herbert and Harold that Schutzbach could answer some of their questions since he knew Billy, her husband's nickname, well and had been on several contacts with him. She again invited them inside for coffee, and this time they accepted. Inside the old farmhouse, Popeye handed them two thick albums filled with photographs. Harold studied several of them closely with his professional eye. "As much as I know about photography," he said later, "I could not say these photos were faked somehow. They looked real to me." For 10 minutes we could say nothing, remembered Herbert, because our mouths were open. In the magazine, there were only black and white photos in 2 or 3 different positions. But these pictures from up and down, from here and there, clear and in color, were perfect. Schutzbach explained to them how Mir had taken the photographs during his many contacts with the Pleiadians. "If you would like to see landing tacks from a ship," he added, "actually 2 ships, there was a contact 14 days ago. They are quite fresh, I can show them to you." The article in Quick had mentioned nothing about landing tracks. Herbert and Harold had no idea such evidence existed. A few hours earlier they had speculated on whether they would find Mir. And if they did, whether his story would hold up or dissolve into nothing but unsupported claims as had all of the others. Now they sat in Mia's house, looking at photographs even more incredible than those they had seen previously. And here was a man who had been with Mia on several contacts offering to show them physical evidence supporting the man's story. The more they saw in the photo album and heard from Schutzbach, the more intrigued they became. Shortly after Schutzbach made his offer, Herbert and Harold were back in the car again, following him through the streets of Hinwil, then out into the country onto a narrow side road to a place where the road ended. There, they got out of the cars and began to walk. "We walked almost 100 meters through the woods," remembered Herbert, "and then we came to a place where the wood was closed all around and there was a meadow in it. There was very high grass, maybe a little less than a meter. And there were the 6 landing tracks from the 2 ships. I took a picture of them, and I thought, that's not possible, I have never seen anything like that. The grass was turned counterclockwise, right? The interesting thing was the grass was not broken. If you break grass it will lie down, but this grass was not broken. I pulled up some pieces of it and looked at it and it was not broken. I could not understand. If you stand at a place like that, the first thing you think is, how did these landing tracks get here? He must come in with a car or with a helicopter or something to make them. But that was impossible.